Rabbi David Rosen, are you with me and can you hear me?
I am indeed with you and can hear you loud and clear.
Better than that, I can see you as well, which is pretty unusual for me. So that's pretty awesome. And what you don't know, Rabbi Rosen, is I've got the whole blurb on you and the whole spiel about Chief Rabbi of Ireland and Abrahamic Center in Abu Dhabi. But what they left off was Rabbi of Moreh Road and Sea Point, which for me and my perspective is 100 times more relevant because
I agree with you. Those were the most wonderful years of and seminal. Everything I do today in some way was born there in Sea Point.
Expand on that because I'm fascinated by the fact you would say that.
First of all, it was a wonderful community, and of course, it was a much larger community then. And we managed in my time to have 1,500 in shul on a Friday evening. I mean, that's incredible. Today, that shul already is even blocks have been taken out, so you can't even seat that amount, even if you would want to. But there were 1,500 in the summer. Of course, a little inflated with Joe Burgers coming down to the Cape for the summer. But in the winter, we come down to half that. But there were still 800 people in shul. And it was my first rabbinic position. I mean, they were incredibly, incredibly courageous to take me on at such a young age and to lead that mammoth-sized community. They were really wonderful years. Of course, not only was it my rabbinic training in situ, I mean, as much as I'd studied and had all my hasmachot, my smicha, the practical experience was, of course, critically important. I never had it till then, so it was enormously enriching in terms of my rabbinate. But in terms of my whole worldview and especially my engagement of interfaith, it started there in South Africa out of a personal commitment to social justice during the apartheid era, wanting my community to be seen by others to be involved in that struggle as well. And one of the few ways you could do it without immediately running foul of the authorities and being kicked out of the country or thrown into jail was actually through religion. The authorities there were rather nervous about messing around with religion. And I arranged meetings with all the major religious leaders to be able to establish what we call the Interfaith Forum, if only. And it was an incredible experience. I've got so many stories I could tell you about that in the meetings with the Dutch Reformed Church, as well, of course, with the Catholics and the Muslims. But they all came on board. We had this amazing framework at that particular time. It was enormously illustrative for me. First of all, I'd never really thought about other religions and certainly never thought about interfaith relations. I knew that Judaism teaches justice and righteousness and the pursuit of peace, and therefore I was motivated by that. But as I met these people, I discovered not only were they wonderful people, but they were at the same time amazingly ignorant about me, and they had all kinds of prejudices and stereotypes. And I assumed if you're Christian, then you're rooted in Judaism, so you must know what Judaism was called Nechtika Tog. Of course, that wasn't the case. They didn't, and they had a distorted perception. So I realized it was enormously important for me to meet with them, because if they don't know me, then they're going to have these distorted perceptions. If they know me, then I can overcome these barriers and these negative approaches. But you know what? As I engaged them, I realized, yes, they were ignorant about me, but I was pretty ignorant about them too. And I had all kinds of stereotypes about Christians and about Muslims. And if I wanted to be understood, I needed to understand. And as I got engaged, I really got hooked on this. And I realized how enormously important it was. And also realized how few Orthodox rabbis understood that and really were engaged in that. And when I became Chief Rabbi of Ireland, you know, Rabbi Jacobowitz was a predecessor of mine. He used to say 95% of Ireland is Catholic, 5% is Protestant, and I'm Chief Rabbi of the rest. Of course, it's a bit of an exaggeration, but what it means is you can't do your job very well if you're not involved in interfaith relations. And as there were so few Orthodox rabbis deeply committed in that, I started getting brought into all these global frameworks and activities, and then people started asking me to work for them in this field, and it became my vocation. But it started in Cape Town, started in Sea Point.
You've just gotten rid of pretty much most of the questions that I had put down on my piece of paper. And I'm very, very grateful for that, because that means I can just have a chat to you. So that is remarkable. So you're telling me the seeds of your very illustrious career that's taken you to meet popes and heads of states actually germinated in Sea Point, Cape Town, indeed, South Africa.
In the most wonderful congregation that I could have ever dreamed of serving.
You then leave South Africa and you take up this position in Ireland. Ireland is making the news big time currently with its very vocal stance. One wonders whether they're worse than Spain or not worse than Spain. I don't know, it's another discussion. But are you surprised by the reactions that you've seen coming out of Ireland towards Israel?
Unfortunately not. First of all, let me say that just as I want the world to know that Israel as a whole is not our government, and people need to be able to distinguish between that, so people need to distinguish between Irish society at large and the Irish government. In my experience, and I continue to experience that, there is a great love of Jews in Ireland for a number of different reasons, and even historically a solidarity with Israel. I mean, perhaps that's diminished and a number of factors have played a role there, but certainly I don't think that the positions of the government of Ireland reflect those of the society at large. Nevertheless, Ireland, because it's the only real country in Western Europe that was colonized and therefore was dominated by an imperial force, tends always to identify with what it sees as the underdog. So there's a fundamental disposition, predisposition in Ireland towards sympathy for the underdog. But there are a few other things, factors as well. I mean, when the troubles in Ireland were at their height, there was very much a sense in the north amongst Protestants that they were in a situation similar to that of Israel, surrounded by numbers larger than them, and they were, as it were, holding, were rallying the ranks around the lager, to use a nice South African term. And because the Protestants automatically identified with the Jews, in this case Israel, I mean, once again, there's a problem always of over-identification of Jews in Israel, even though we want as much identification as possible. Nevertheless, that led very much to the Catholics in the north identifying with the Palestinians. And that spread, as it were, more to Catholic society and through Sinn Féin, through the, if you like, the nationalist movement. But perhaps the biggest factor was that the first Irish soldiers to have been killed as Irish soldiers were killed by the South Lebanese army that was fighting against Palestinian areas in South Lebanon. And the South Lebanese army was a surrogate of Israel, and therefore the attitude was Israel's responsible for our deaths. And that led to very bad press at that time when I was chief rabbi. I mean, in South Africa, I faced death threats over my positions that became public because Sea Point had such a large attendance in Shul. There were always journalists, and therefore I got disproportionate media coverage. So people
Interesting.
knew about me. So I got threats on the phone and death threats against our daughters. And I was even called out of an event with John Forster because I was a chaplain to the mayor, the late Teddy Moorburger. And I was called out because somebody had called up and spoken to our home help and told her that they were coming over to kill the children. So I had those death threats in South Africa, but I don't know how seriously we took them. I suppose we did. But in Ireland, the police took their threats against me very seriously because the chief rabbi in Ireland actually was the representative for Israel. While the British ambassador, the ambassador of Israel to Britain, was also responsible for Ireland, he wasn't there as a continuous presence, and therefore the chief rabbi was very much the address. And I had continuous police protection there because of that at that particular time. But I say attitudes changed. I mean, you've got to remember that at one stage, Ireland very much identified with Israel as facing the same enemy, namely British colonialism. And the great Lord Mayor of Dublin, Bobby Briscoe, whose son Ben Briscoe was also a Lord Mayor, and we two Jewish Lord Mayors of Dublin. And incidentally, more Jews in the Irish Doyle, the Parliament, than Protestants, even though there are 100 times as many Protestants in my time, which is re really quite remarkable. But he was involved in gun running, for not just for the IRA against the British, but for the Etzel, for
You're
Israeli nationalists against
joking.
it. So there was
Goodness.
significant collaboration between Jewish nationalist and Irish nationalist forces in the early days.
I hear what you're saying, and it's really good to hear that there's another side to the story which I've been told. I think you've been quite charitable. Their history in World War II wasn't great. They've got some
Well,
historical
that's
reckoning
again,
that they need to do as Irish, don't they?
that again is not simple. I mean, I think most Irish were today would be quite horrified to know that De Valera actually issued condolences to the German ambassador on the death of Hitler.
It's exactly what I
But
was thinking. Yeah.
in order to understand that, and of course it is awful, but in order to understand that, you have to understand how much the demon in terms of Irish nationalism was Britain. And it was seen as standing in the way of their self-fulfillment. And therefore, anyone who was bringing Britain down was seen as aiding and abetting the Irish cause. So that's no excuse whatsoever. But nevertheless, it does help us at least to put things within some kind of context. It wasn't out of any anti-Semitic motive. It was out of their own nationalist perversion.
I'm looking at the time and I'm thinking I really need to make the most of you. I only have you for another 5, 6 minutes or so. Your life's endeavor has been in outreach, interfaith dialogue, a very noble cause. Are you shocked by the responses, the level of anti-Semitism that you're seeing in the world today, or is this not a surprise to you?
No, it is a surprise. It's a shock. It's a great disappointment. And it simply means that I've got to work harder.
Okay. Okay. I hear you. And related to that, talk to me about the Abrahamic complex in Abu Dhabi.
So the Abrahamic family house actually is really, I'm really glad that that question follows on from the previous question and comment, because some of the few bright spots during this most depressing, dark period for Israel and the Jewish people have actually come from the Gulf and from the United Arab Emirates. And none of the signatories to the Abraham Accords broke off, though there is always the danger that certain steps might be taken too far on the part of Israel in its efforts to what it sees as defending itself from the threat of Hamas, that may indeed lead to the collapse of the Accords, but so far they haven't. And not only have the Accords been maintained, but the care of the UAE for its Jewish communities there has been quite remarkable. Immediately after when the war started, a message was sent from the president to the Jewish communities to tell them not to worry, that they consider them to be an integral part of their society and that they're under their protection and that welfare is paramount. And even though the, if you like, the makeshift Batei Knesset, the makeshift shuls in Dubai, were not able to formally function, though some did informally. The synagogue, which is part of the Abrahamic family house, which is the only national official synagogue built by the government for the Jewish community, where incidentally you cannot become a member because you cannot pay dues to the government, where you can't make a donation, and where the kiddush on Shabbat and Friday night meal for those there is paid for by the government. You don't have anything like that. And that first time ever a government to build a purpose-built synagogue for a Jewish community is done by an Arab Muslim government. And that's part and process of the amazing changes that have taken place and some that have begun that I've been involved in, not only with the UAE and its Muslim leadership, but also with Saudi Arabia, where I've been privileged to meet two kings. And I think the only rabbi, the only maybe Jew to have been received in the palace by King Salman, where there have also been dramatic changes, where had there not been a war, and that, of course, was part and parcel of Hamas's intention, we might already now have diplomatic relations with Saudi Arabia. And all these interfaith activities are inextricably bound up with these pillars. The Abrahamic Family House is an amazing complex that emerged out of the visit of Pope Francis to Abu Dhabi in 2019, and very much the pet project of the king, the president, who is the king of the UAE, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, and where you have a functioning synagogue with a rabbi. It's an Orthodox synagogue alongside some distance away from a mosque, some distance away from a church. They're connected by a forum where there are conferences and activities that bring people together. The church comes under the authority of the Vatican. The mosque comes under Al-Azhar, the most important institute of Muslim learning in Cairo. And for the beginning, I had the responsibility of helping find a rabbi and appoint a rabbi and install a rabbi, and I still serve as its interfaith advisor. And it's an amazingly positive development. And generally, attitudes towards Jews and Judaism have changed 180 degrees, I would say, in that part of the world. And there are some other bright spots too, so it's not all dark.
Other bright spots like what?
Well, I think Morocco has also been very good, and there's still quite a significant flow of Israelis, of interfaith activity and intercultural exchanges going on with Morocco. And then I've got many Muslim leaders within Europe who are significant exceptions to the rule. An organization I helped establish is the Muslim Jewish Leadership Council in Europe that involves the Conference of European Rabbis, the body that brings together all the Orthodox rabbis in Europe, together with the European Muslim Leadership Association. And they issued a very important statement as well, and they've been very supportive. So there have been significant bright spots. By definition, and you understand media much better than me, what's going to boost rating and get coverage and get
The extremes.
visibility are going to be the negative things.
Sure.
And so the positive doesn't always get hurt.
Let's be honest. I mean, it's been 2 years of awful Al Jazeera images being screened to a billion Muslims. Your job must be incredibly difficult right now, four times more important than it ever was, and yet so much more challenging. Surely there's no
Absolutely.
bandwidth to hear your message, is what I'm saying, until this war
It's
gets sorted one way or another.
unquestionably far more difficult. And as you say, that makes it all the more important. But I am encouraged by the wonderful people I meet. And almost by definition, those who are going to seek to meet with me are going to be the more positive elements.
Are you concerned about the schism that appears to be developing between the Israeli Jewish community versus the most powerful Jewish community in the world, the American Jewish community? Are you worried about that?
Yes and no. I mean, again, consider that Israeli society is split, if not down the middle. Probably there's a majority today who would like to get rid of Netanyahu if it could, but his coalition with some very negative elements, of which I, as an Israeli, am very ashamed, nevertheless, is pretty stable until his term concludes. But to be able to have 500,000 go out in a protest in Rabin Square against the war and calling for the hostages to be returned and to finish with the terrible carnage that is taking so many lives, both on Israeli side as well as Palestinians. 500,000, we're talking a country of 10 million, but we have 1.5 million Arabs amongst them, and Arabs weren't amongst those in any significant number. So it's really 500,000 out of 8.5 million. That's an incredible proportion of people who therefore are profoundly opposed to the government's policies and to its own particular approach. Now, that schism therefore means there's a schism within Israeli society, and not just one. There are a number of different cleavages and points of tension within Israeli society. And that, in a way, is actually feeding into perceptions abroad. And I would say the Jewish community in the United States is also quite split. And there's much more support for the government coming from Orthodox quarters, but from the vast majority of American Jews, it's not so supported. But it's a question, again, more of the government of Israel rather than Israeli society at large. So while it concerns me that there's any schism within the Jewish people, nevertheless, I think in many respects, it is many of those that are critical of our government are doing us a service.
Looking at the time, I don't have any left. Final question for you. Your message to South African Jews prior to Rosh Hashanah, which is around the corner.
My message to South African Jews is that you have already, my late father, Rabbi Koppel Rosen, when he visited South Africa in the 50s, I remember coming back home saying that South African Jewry was the most wonderful Jewish community in the world.
Oh, wow.
And my experience was also that. And I think South African Jewry has a wonderful heritage, but its heritage is not just in the field of its Jewish identity, of Zionism, and of Yiddishkeit. Its heritage is also in the area of Menschlichkeit. And if you are not a mensch, you are not really a good Jew. Of course, there's more to being a good Jew than just being a mensch. But if you are not a mensch, you are not a good Jew. South Africa has a heritage of Menschlichkeit. And often today, you come across those who don't know how to value it as much as they should. And my message would be, South African Jewry, you have been a beacon of Menschlichkeit. May you continue to deepen your Yiddishkeit, but never lose your Menschlichkeit.
Rabbi David Rosen, what an honor chatting to you this afternoon. Shana Tova to you and your family, and thank you for making the time for us today.
Thank you. Shana Tova Umetuka.